Hello, everyone. Welcome to North and South Podcasts. This is Tim. I've got Ralph James with me today.
Hi, Ralph. Folks.
Ralph spoke very well last time he was on a few months ago. He stood as an independent candidate in the general election in Sefton Central.
Got it right this time.
Got it right this time. And he was in a very safe Labour seat, I hasten to add. But he ran a very passionate campaign, and he's always been involved in politics. He's been a councillor before. He is very community-minded, and he's lived in the Bootle area all his life, pretty much, Ralph.
Yep.
Is that true?
Yeah.
And he speaks very, very well. Now, on the last podcast Ralph was on, we spoke a lot about local politics, national politics, international politics. And today we're going to go into history in more detail and local history, because he mentioned a little bit about his dad last time and his dad's experiences of the war and outside the war. And I'm a big passionate believer in oral history and passing on the history of common people, normal people, as it were, who have got amazing stories to tell. And even though many people think that their stories aren't important, within a couple of generations, we're losing the Blitz generation. I remember when I was young, the First World War generation died, the people who went through that. And if we don't record these oral histories and traditions, we lose them. And I think that these kinds of podcasts with people like Ralph are very, very important. Ralph is also very fluent and speaks very well, and he's got his notes, his prep. So I'm gonna pass over to Ralph in a minute. Before I go any further, though, I just want to say, although me and Ralph are big on politics, we understand the importance of history, philosophy, improving yourself, developing yourself, joining groups so that you're more effective in campaigning for a better world, a better life, all of those things. And if you want to come on to talk about politics or history or your family story, well-being, I'm big on well-being and things like that as well, please get involved. If you can, like, share, subscribe, support the podcast any way you can. You can contribute on coffee.com. The details will be in the notes. The price of a cup of coffee once a month is a massive help to keep this project going. And also, if you want to get involved in other ways, you can, and get involved in the charity side. We do podcasting and heritage podcasting with vulnerable groups. We're doing more of that moving forward. And heritage is a big part of what we're going to discuss today. So, Ralph, anything you want to say before we begin?
No, you've done a fine job of easing me into that. We're very like-minded with regards to our sense of the value and the pleasant weight that is on our shoulders to relate the oral history of the ordinary person. And as it happens, my dad was fated to have a very interesting, if that's not too slight a way of putting it, wartime experience. I've often humorously described it, but with a serious undertone, as being a world cruise punctuated by moments of extreme horror and terror.
Yeah.
And he got to have opportunities to meet people and to go places that he would never ever have dreamt of doing had he remained in civilian life and the war had not happened. I think it's important, first of all, for me to say that my dad was not a young man when the war started. He'd already had supervisory experience as a tradesman and was 30 before the war started in September 1939. He actually turned 30 in March 1939. And that, to some extent, informed the position that the Royal Navy, when he joined it, gave him. And by the fact that he was employed in the capacity of the captain's tiger, the captain's personal steward, it meant that he had insights into what was happening at the highest levels of command on the ships that he was given to serve on, and also that he had contact with all of the other ranks on the ship. So he had a unique position. In fact, the captain used to use him as a rapporteur between what was happening below decks and to get some feeling of how the ship was operating as a collective, as it were. So he had a very unique role, and his personality, his character was ideally suited. The Navy chose very well when they gave him that role. And indeed, he was on three ships and he never varied in terms of where they put him. He was a Captain Stewart right the way through the war. Now, part of the reason for that was because my dad was in a reserved occupation as a foreman plasterer, helping to construct the bombing shelters in anticipation of the Blitz. And before he ever joined the Navy, he was part of the ARP, And because he was fit and small...
That's the air raid.
The air raid precautions, yeah. Who used to go to incidents of bombing and to generally alert the public about the imminence of planes coming over.
So was this part of the phony wall, the preparation for the bombs, or is this during the actual
Blitz
itself?
Well, the construction of the shelters was in the preparation of what you would call the phony wall, the first part, during the Battle of France. And then he was actually, before he volunteered, was involved in the ARP once the bombing had started, the air raid precautions once the bombing was started, and he was actually allocated the role of going into collapsed buildings to see if he could help bring anyone out from the spaces within the collapsed buildings. And one of the first stories that he told me about that was very tragic and an immediate taste of the reality of war, particularly for civilian population. He came up with a little girl who had been killed, and he said she was in an attitude of prayer, covered in dust, but otherwise completely unblooded. And she'd not been killed by explosion, she'd been killed by the blast. And having to get her out of the space into which the building had collapsed, gave him an early insight into the nature of the consequences of suffering aerial bombardment. So it steeled his attitude towards doing his bit, as it were. And that led him to want to join up in the armed forces. He said that the reason that he joined the Navy, and his brother, who had been a steward on the liners and was now a chief petty officer, his reason for wanting to join the forces was because he wanted his choice of service, because we were from a maritime family. They were all fisher folk. And my grandfather was a ship's carpenter, and my uncle, as I said, had been a chief steward on the liners and had some very interesting experiences with some celebrity passengers, and also some amusing incidents during Prohibition with the gangsters.
So Prohibition was when alcohol was banned in the US, 1919 to 1933. So indeed. He had experience of that, did he?
My uncle did.
Yeah.
Because of my uncle's position as a steward, he then was made a chief petty officer when he transferred to the Royal Navy. And as I say, my dad wasn't at that stage being called up because he was in the reserved occupation. But my dad said he decided to volunteer. And my uncle, I think, pulled strings to make sure that he was enlisted as a member of a thing called T124X, which was volunteer reserves. And my dad said the reason that he wanted to volunteer rather than wait for conscription, which he thought was coming, was because he would have his choice of service, and he wanted to be in the Navy, not in the Army. Mm. Anyway, he did, and they made him the captain steward, and everything that he experienced during the war, I think, in terms of his service during the active service, was related to that position one way or another, or to a later, greater or lesser extent. The first ship he joined was a catapult-launched aircraft carrying a merchantman. And this was very much a stopgap measure. I alluded to this in the previous podcast, which carried three Hurricane fighters. And it was that much of a stopgap measure that the fighters were considered expendable. The principal danger to convoys in the North Atlantic, which is where this ship was stationed, was from long-range bombers attacking convoys. And these ships were converted so that the steam catapult would launch the fighter. The fighter would engage the bomber, hopefully shoot it down, and then the pilot would ditch the plane. The plane would be lost, and the pilot would be picked up. It carried three fighters, and once the fighters had all been used, if they were, then the ship reverted to its secondary role as an anti-aircraft cruiser.
So let me get this right. Later in the war, you know the pictures where aeroplanes are landing back on aircraft carriers? Did that come later in the war?
Yes.
So early on, they were going up and that was it?
That was it. It was that much of a stopgap measure because of the use of these bombers that the planes were considered expendable.
So they were like pawns, basically, in the bigger game of catching the bishop or the knight.
Exactly.
The
And as I related in the previous podcast, my dad was also allocated an anti-aircraft gun action station. So he was shooting at the bomber as well, if it was within range. And on one particular occasion, the fighter pilot who'd been launched shot down the bomber, and the bomber ditched next to the ship that my dad was on. And my dad said that if you wanted a good example of the futility of war, you couldn't have a better one than that experience, because in the space of 5 minutes, he went from trying to kill the bomber crew as one of the anti-aircraft gunners to willing the German crew to get out of the ditched plane. And they actually watched the German crew drown, and everyone was willing the German crew to get out, because at that point they were all victims of the perils of the sea.
Yeah.
And that common humanity overrode the fact that they were erstwhile enemies of a couple of minutes previously. Anyway, my dad was on that ship for most of the Battle of the Atlantic, and I'm not quite sure why, but he was then transferred to another ship, which was, again, a converted civilian vessel. It was a former Isle of Man boat called the Tynwald, which had been taken over by the Royal Navy and recommissioned as HMS Tynwald. And on that ship, again, he was the captain steward, and he was involved in the invasion of North Africa. The principal role of that ship was as an anti-aircraft cruiser. And as they were invading a place, they were trying to take a town called Bougie in North Africa.
Do you know what country Bougie is in?
I think it's in Algeria, but I'm not quite sure.
So right on the north coast, on the Mediterranean.
Yeah. And an Italian submarine called the Argo put a torpedo into the ship and sank her. And my dad told me that he remembers getting off the ship as the guardrail round the ship was going under the water. Now, this is not the thing you're told to do, because if a ship is listing that much, you're likely to get cracked on the head by something falling from the high side. But fortunately, that didn't happen. And he got into the water, he swam, and was picked up by a thing called a Carley float, which was a type of life raft. And they paddled ashore. And he also told me that he witnessed an aerial bombardment of the town from a set of railway arches. But with regards to his experiences of being torpedoed, he said that if you're going to be torpedoed in the Mediterranean in warm water, 3 miles from shore, not in the middle of Murmansk or off Murmansk, on the Arctic convoys where you had 3 minutes to live because of the cold.
I believe on the ship as well, if you're in like the boiler room or down below, you're not getting out. But if you're in a better position on the boat, you do have a chance of getting out.
Absolutely. She is a war grave. Yeah. The ship is still there, and there were a number of casualties. Not very many, but a number.
But he managed to get off.
Yes.
I don't think that's something that you can really appreciate unless you experience it, going into the water like that on a sinking ship. Even in the Med, 3 miles from the coast, it's just a terrifying experience. Well,
interestingly enough, I asked him what was the most frightened he'd ever been during the war. And he said, if I'm being perfectly honest, being back in Bootle during the Blitz, he said, and I was frankly relieved and glad to get back to sea. And he left his early 20s wife, because my mum was quite a few years younger than my dad, with a young baby to suffer the terrors of aerial bombardment, and he felt safer at sea.
That's interesting, that, isn't it? Because Bootle, for the record, Bootle took more bombs per area than any other part of the United Kingdom.
I understand that, obviously, for reasons of propaganda, the main thing you hear about the bombing is Coventry and the East End of London. But there's 1 square mile of Bootle that was supposed to have been more heavily bombed than anywhere else in the country.
It gets one mention in the official history of the war, Bootle. But it says Bootle was bombed heavily. But again, the theatres of war were so wide, it is just a footnote, isn't it?
But it is true that Churchill himself said that the one time he was really worried about losing the war was with respect to the Atlantic convoys being cut off by German blockade submarines, bombers, surface raiders like the Bismarck. Mm. And it was absolutely pivotal to the outcome. Liverpool's role was pivotal to the outcome of the Second World War.
Yeah, I don't know if have you been to the museum in Liverpool?
Yes,
I Western Approaches Museum, and people who are listening in Liverpool and beyond, if you ever get a chance to go there, it's basically the war room subterranean where the whole Atlantic operation was kind of orchestrated. And there was one fatality in there. A woman fell from a ladder, you know, on one of those big maps.
Yeah.
And died, actually, within there. And it was closed for 30 years because of the Official Secrets Act and then opened. But it's a bit of a unsung hero of Liverpool, that site, I think.
I knew somebody who was an antiquarian who sold antiques, and he reckons he got a lot of very, very historically valuable stuff out of a skip when the war rooms were being redesigned, I think, or whatever you call it, for purposes of being an exhibit. He later lost a number of those findings when the council, when he was ill, moved all of his stuff out of his house. He was very, very angry about it and died extremely unresolved with regard to it.
It's amazing. That's why things like what we're doing now are important. People take things for granted, and within 2-3 decades, it's like that was not preserved. We saw a classic case where a lot of Holocaust deniers, we're going to talk about the Holocaust another time, because Auschwitz wasn't preserved, no one thought we better keep this as a record. All of a sudden, the site falls into, you know, ruin, as it were, and then it was kept as a site. And thankfully, that was done to record it. Because at the moment, all the conspiracy theories, like history itself, is under attack. Like facts and truth are under attack. It's really important that we remember these important stories.
Absolutely. Plus, you've got to learn the lessons. The struggle for the control of what is regarded as valid history is part of history itself. It's an ongoing process, and that's one of the reasons I think these podcasts are important. You said in your intro, well, I would call it a pleasant weight on our shoulders to make sure that the experiences of ordinary people are not lost in the official narrative, you know, the 1066 and all that of the kings and queens.
Just on the Atlantic, the Battle of the Atlantic, I believe about 30,000 people in the Merchant Navy, the Royal Navy, went down during the war in the Atlantic. And it was a similar number of German submariners on the U-boats.
Very high loss rate.
So early on in the war, the U-boats were on top. Later in the war, the Allies used convoys. They had better technology. I forget what it's called now, where they bounce the sound off the bottom of the sea.
The term my dad always used was ASDIG.
ASDIG, yeah. Anti-submarine. I can't remember
what it is. I can't remember what the initial stand.
But basically, they'd go over it, and if there was a sub there, the sound would bounce back quicker. Mm-hmm. They'd then go around, speed up, and then drop the depth charges, not knowing where the submarine was. It was like cat and mouse.
Well, the force that operated out of Bootle was the most effective anti-U-boat force of all. Captain Walker was known to be the equivalent of an air ace with regards to hunting U-boats down.
There's a statue of him down at the Pierhead as well in Liverpool, and also a monument to the war dead.
There's also a painting of him going up the stairs at Bootle Town Hall.
Yeah, there's a preservation. I know Bobby Brennan has spoken about that as well. Isn't there some U-boat flags in there, or there's some flags from the Navy and World
There's
War
a number, II, the, if you go into the main council chamber, there are battle ensigns, some of which are torn to pieces, but that's because they've been used, you know, in real... There's a famous phrase, sound general chase, and that basically was go after the U-boats, and those battle flags relate to that period. Bobby also found a wall clock, I think it was from Bedford Road School, which was in the basement of the town hall, and had it exhibited because it was destroyed by the Blitz, and the time of the explosion is recorded on the clock.
And just for listeners as well, I've done a few podcasts about the Blitz, but there was a lot of bombing in 1940, but in May 1941 it was this last big salvo, wasn't it,
the
before
May Blitz,
went to the Eastern Front.
Yeah.
But getting back to your dad in a moment, I believe 3/4 of U-boaters were killed in the latter stages of the war, and the Allies were then a bit more on top. But going down in the sea, in the Atlantic, as your dad said, you know, going down in the Med's a different thing, isn't it? It's a terrible fate, isn't it?
Well, I think it's interesting that the film series Das Boot went down so well with the audiences in this country. Das Boot is about the fate of a U-boat crew on
operation. Series, isn't it?
Absolutely,
the original series.
Yeah, and again, it's one of those examples of the enemy, so-called, being treated as just other human beings with the same experiences as British submariners had. Yeah.
Have you read the book of that? Or
no, I've seen the Fassbinder film.
The book's really good, but the series is incredible.
I think the music in it is extremely effective and appropriate to the dramatic emphasis.
So anyway, sorry, getting back to your dad on this second boat.
Right, the second boat was sunk He was repatriated eventually through Gibraltar to this country.
Yeah.
And then he was allocated a ship, which was yet to be constructed, on the west coast of America. And he duly embarked on one of the big passenger liners. It was either the Queen Elizabeth or the Queen Mary. I'm not quite sure which. Yeah. But on the outward journey, he actually went with Churchill, who was going over to a conference, Churchill being, of course, the war leader of the British, to go over to a conference with Roosevelt. So that was a very important journey.
Yeah.
He was then,
just before the Americans had joined the war?
Yes, or? It was in the run-up to the... Well, Churchill was trying to bring the Americans into the war.
So Churchill's on a boat going to the United States,
yeah,
effectively to say, we need your help?
Yes, well, to try and... I don't know whether he spoke to the American houses.
Yeah, and your dad was on that boat?
Yeah, he was actually on the ship with Churchill. I don't know whether he actually ever saw him. But the reason that these passenger liners were chosen as troop ships and to carry somebody as important to the war efforts as Churchill was because of their speed,
yeah,
and because the U-boats at that time couldn't keep up with the so they, and at that stage, once they got past a certain point, there was no long-range bombers to attack them because they didn't have the endurance to follow the ships. But the issue of air cover was always a feature of the Battle of the Atlantic. Anyway, that was post my dad's involvement with the Battle of the Atlantic anyway. And he was simply a passenger going over to join the Royal Navy activities in another theatre of war. So he'd been in two theatres of war by this stage, as well as having been in the ARP. He went to a place called Asbury Park, New Jersey. And Asbury Park, New Jersey is the it's a blue-collar shipping, not unlike Liverpool, the shipping town. And Bruce Springsteen heralds from there.
Yeah.
And he got a job. As I mentioned earlier in the podcast, my family were fisher folk on Deeside. And my dad could actually, when I was a kid, take me over to Park Gate and tell me who lived in all the cottages. Because
Park Gate is on the west of the Wirral Peninsula.
Indeed it is. Yeah. Yeah,
it's like
very silted up now.
But it's kind of, yeah, it's silted up. It used to be on the River Dee, where, you know, quite an affluent area historically.
Yeah, it was on the way to Chester, and it predated Liverpool as being an... Handel actually took the first manuscript for The Messiah to Ireland for its premiere performance, embarking at Parkgate.
Really?
An interesting piece of sidelight of history. Anyway, he got to Asbury Park, New Jersey, and in spite of the fact that the particularly non-commissioned officers, which he was, weren't supposed to do anything other than be paid by His Majesty, my dad got a job on the quiet as a seafood waiter because he knew all about seafood because he'd seen his mum preparing it since he was knee-high to. And I remember him telling me about how she used to get cockles in the bath and she'd leave them in the bath with oatmeal overnight. And the cockles would end up eating the oatmeal and basically providing stuffing and cleaning themselves out, yeah, for when they were eaten. So he was a seafood waiter for most of the time he was in Asbury Park, New Jersey. But there was a very interesting incident, probably because he had access to the captain again. He got a ticket to a thing called the Stage Door Canteen. And the Stage Door Canteen was a Hollywood initiative to help the Allied war effort. And I think, theoretically drawn at random, Allied service personnel were given these tickets. And then they would make their way to New York, where the Stage Door Canteen was. And the Hollywood moguls had taken over the management of what was basically a nightclub or restaurant. And there were different tables to which the service personnel were allocated. And on each table was a Hollywood A-lister of the day, a male and a female, because everything was binary then. Huh. And this particular night, my dad's two hosts were Elsa Lanchester, who was better known to history as the Bride of Frankenstein, and who was also the wife of Charles Laughton, the English actor who became legendarily Henry VIII, in a Hollywood version of the lives of or the wives of Henry VIII, and also Edward G. Robinson, who was famous for gangster acting. And my dad told me that Edward G. Robinson told him personally that his real name was some, I forget, no disrespect intended, but unpronounceable Eastern European name. That was his real name. And he said, I'm a Romanian Jew, and I know what Nazism is all about firsthand. And in spite of the fact that he was getting on at the time, he said, I will do everything I can and move heaven and earth to make sure that the Nazis are defeated and that I can do everything I can to help the Allied war effort.
What year is this? Do you know what year this is?
This would be about 1942-43.
Yeah,
42-43. Yeah. Anyway, that was one thing that would never ever have... I mean, he'd never ever have gotten into that sort of set of circumstances if he remained a plasterer. But... or for that matter, if he'd been in another arm of the services, because yeah. most of the people, by definition, who were going to be in America were likely to be from the Navy. Yeah. Anyway, then...
So was that a fundraiser, pretty much, or it was, just trying to get people behind the war effort?
It was heavily publicised to build morale up, I think, as much as anything else. They also used to... one actress in particular, who was marketed originally... She was actually German, and she got out of Germany, called Hedy Lamarr, whose real name was Hedwig Kiesler, I think. Mm. But they changed it because her surname sounded too like the Yiddish slang for backside, which is Keister.
Yeah.
Anyway, she used to sell kisses, and it turns out that she was... absolutely brilliant at science, and she wanted to do scientific research, and Hollywood wanted her to sell kisses. And she says in her biography that she was extremely frustrated not having her talents used. She wrote a book which I think was called My Face Was My Misfortune. And she was indirectly responsible for Wi-Fi, or one of the main people who originated what became Wi-Fi.
Really?
Yeah, for preventing the, it's to do with guiding submarine guiding torpedoes.
Right.
So anyway, eventually the ship was ready for my dad to go and join it. These ships were known, affectionately as Woolworth carriers, aircraft carriers, because Woolworths were famous for selling lots of stuff, you know, piling it high and selling it cheap. And they were knocking them out at some ridiculous rate on the west coast of the States. Yeah. And she was originally commissioned as an American warship, which meant that the living conditions were far better than they would have been if it had been built to British Navy specifications. So they were very popular with the crews. The British Navy took it over. She was then renamed. I don't remember what the name of the American warship's name was, but she became HMS Amir.
Yeah.
Now, Amir is the Arabic word for a sea leader, which is the origins of our word admiral.
Yeah.
And my dad then travelled, had the experience of travelling across America on one of the observation car long trains. And a story that sticks in my mind with great affection is, he said they had a black conductor on the train, and every morning he would open the sleeping compartments and announce to the assembled crew, "Still in America, boss, still in America." And they ended up in British Columbia, and they took over the ship.
So he went up into Canada.
They must have done, they must have gone up. British Columbia's west coast.
We're going up to the west coast now, facing the Pacific.
Yeah.
So he's been everywhere.
Yeah.
He's done all that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he's ended up in
now,
the Pacific.
There's a lovely letter I've got in my hand now, which was written on the 9th of October 1943. And it was written by a lady to my mum, saying how lucky she was to have a husband who idolised her. And who used to come for meals, because certain Americans and Canadians used to put up Allied service personnel and give them a bit of a treat. And she describes how she treats them and how it makes a nice change from the repetitious, boring meals that they were all complaining about having to endure on board the ship. What particularly, I could read the whole letter, but I won't. It's just the end of it really brings it home to you about the nature of history, because she says, "My very kindest regards to you and all good wishes for a happy reunion and the peace for which we are all praying when the right time comes, sincerely." And then she signs it. Now, when that letter was written, the outcome of the war was by no means certain. So I've got this in my hand now, because the Allies did win the war and fascism was defeated. It could have been so different.
you need to keep that somewhere safe, mate.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, when I got it out, it happened to get a drop of water on it, and the ink smudged. And I thought, that ink has smudged after 80 years.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they set sail for what turned out to be Ceylon, as it was known then, Sri Lanka as it is now. Yeah. And they, I think, went through the Panama Canal. My dad obviously got talking to the captain during the wee small hours and stuff, and part of his job, indeed, was to be a captain's confidant, as well as gopher and general factotum. Yeah. One interesting little story he told me about that is his relationship with the captain. The captain was a big drinker. A lot of the captains were. And on this particular occasion, my dad was due to feed the captain his, or to give the captain his evening drink. And the captain liked a particular variety of scotch. And my dad opened a new bottle of scotch and was just about to put it into the glass. And the captain said, "No, stop, James. Take the bottle, put it on the back of your hand, invert it so none escapes.
Yeah.
Then put it back the right way up and look at the back of your hand." This wouldn't be allowed now, by the way. Yeah. And anyway, he did this, and there was a ring, an oily ring on the back of his hand. And the captain said to him, "Don't ever open a bottle of scotch for me again without doing that. That oily substance is called fusel oil, and it's poisonous. You must make sure that you remove that from any bottles that you give me in the future."
Wow.
Now, talk about health and safety.
While you're drinking bottles of scotch.
Well, yeah. While it was, presumably the distillation methods. I mean, I don't know whether this is true, but I remember being told it. You know, that even with a very good scotch at that time, you know, there were procedures that had to be observed because of the relative lack of refinement of the distillation processes.
That's fascinating.
I mean, you know, the odds against that story surviving as an anecdote. I mean, that's the beauty of this podcast.
Yeah.
Little gems like that. Anyway, during the wee small hours, they'd exchange stories about their personal histories. And my dad had told the captain that he had a sister who lived in Durban in South Africa. Now, prior to the war, our neighbour in number 11, Gardner, had been in South Africa, and before the war started, when my mum and dad moved into our house, he got talking to this neighbour, and the neighbour said to him, "It's a small world, Mr. James." He said, "Did you know that there was a Bootel Villa in South Africa where your sister lives in Durban?" So my dad noted this, but didn't take any particular regard. Anyway, the captain said, when they got to Cape Town, the captain said to him, "By the way, about your sister..." He said, "Here's a chit. Get on a transport plane and fly from Cape Town to Durban and you can see your sister." So my dad gets in this. It was actually an Avro Anson transport plane. And he landed in an airfield out on the outskirts of Durban. And he went out and asked for directions as to how he got into the town centre where his sister lived, and showed people her address, and they said, "Oh yeah, there's a bus there that goes straight there. You can pick it up at that bus stop opposite." So he's standing at the bus stop, looks up, and there's Bootel Villa opposite him. Now, what's the odds against, you know, the story that had been told by his neighbour 5 or 6 years earlier being verified?
And he just
verified.
Remembered that Bootel Villa in Durban, yeah. And there it was.
There it was. Yeah, so he that actually gets me on to, when you mentioned South Africa, particularly at that time, that gets me on to another story about racial discrimination. And my dad always said to me, he very much liked, my sister, as all white colonials did, had servants who she was extremely fond of and who were extremely fond of her, and my dad loved them as well. He said they were very, 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 very caring, lovely people, always smiling. But he said the worst racism he ever saw in the whole of the war was in the southern states of the United States. He said it wasn't in South Africa, and that was during the pre-apartheid period, where, if anything, it was even worse.
Hmm.
He said his experience in the southern states of America included actually seeing a policeman kick a black man off the sidewalk out of his way. He re-embarked on the aircraft carrier, and they sailed to a place called Trincomalee. Now, the British have a British Navy has a deep water harbour in Scarpa Flow in the north of Scotland.
I've been there.
Right.
Is it on Orkney or Shetland?
So Orkney.
Orkney, yeah.
Yeah. And it's chosen because it's naturally well-defended and it has the depth of water. There's a similar situation with regards to the Trincomalee, and it became the home of the British Far Eastern Fleet. The aircraft carrier was parked there, if you like, for a long period, awaiting developments with regards to the war with Japan. A couple of stories from his time while they were waiting to be put into action, although she was actually launching planes to engage in attacks on Malaya against the Japanese. But he said he didn't go off the ship for about 9 months. He saved up his wages and he went to one of the most expensive jewellers in, I think it was Colombo. I'm not quite sure.
Which is in Sri Lanka.
Yeah. And he went to the most prestigious jeweller's shop and bought my mum a great big ruby ring for which the place was famous. Cut a long story short, when he got it home, she went to get it valued and she was told it wasn't worth the cost of making it, that it was paste.
Did he still have the receipt? Or?
But he didn't. After that, he didn't go off the ship for about 9 months. He said, for a start, it was so hot. He always used to say, if you're cold, you can get warm.
Yeah.
But if you're too warm, there's not a lot that can be done about it. And he developed a thing called prickly heat.
Yeah.
And eventually, he had to be evacuated temporarily to a hill camp, which turned out to be effectively a British concentration camp for Axis prisoners of war in a place called Dayatalawa. And he was sent there because of the climate, and he recovered from the prickly heat. But he said that you had to be very, very careful. Handrails seemed to come into this periodically because he said all of the crew were told, do not put your elbow on the handrail because it will fry. And he said he actually saw eggs fried on the deck. It was that hot.
Just explain what prickly heat is. Just
prickly heat is a reaction to the body not being able to cope with the ambient temperature around it.
Mm. And this, if this goes on for an extended period of time, it can become dangerous.
Oh, yeah. It can kill you.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so he had a number of experiences just not going off the ship. The other thing, the image that sticks in my mind was, he said it happened on one occasion and he thought there was an eclipse. And what it turned out to be was there were huge flocks of fruit bats. And at a certain time of day, all the fruit bats would collectively fly, like starlings do in this country. And he said they would literally block the sun out.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Well, I think, I must say, I'm not very good with heat. I just couldn't think of anything worse than being in that kind of environment.
Mm.
I'm the same as you. I mean, sorry, as your dad, I think if it's cold, I can do something about it. As I'm getting older, maybe not as much, but the heat just drives me to insanity, particularly some of the summers we've had recently.
Yeah.
But that's an example of what it's like when you're travelling and you're going to these places. You have this idea that, oh, it's all cosy and comfortable. It's far from it, isn't it?
Indeed, indeed. Anyway, getting back to the war service of the HMS Amir, they were launching, towards the end of the war, they were launching regular attacks against the Japanese in Malaya. And it was then that, as I mentioned in the previous podcast, that they were attacked by a kamikaze. And this was very late in the war. The kamikaze probably attacked the ship between the first and the second atomic bombs being dropped, but the crew didn't know that then.
So Japan was like, the Japanese soldiers, their military tradition was you fight to the death, you never surrender.
Yeah.
And many of them became kamikazes, where they would fly planes into ships to try and
one-way trips, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. And, well, the term kamikaze, I think, refers originally to suicide missions that the Japanese had engaged in centuries earlier against Kublai Khan.
Mm.
I think that's where the phrase came from. I may be wrong about that, but anyway, I throw that into the mix.
Yeah.
But that crew were killed for nothing because the war was already over.
Yeah.
And if they'd blown the aircraft carrier up, I wouldn't be here, and neither would the ship's complement either. Yeah. They would have died for no good reason because the outcome of the war was already determined, effectively. They were actually planning to sail to, I think it was a place called either Port Swettenham, somewhere.
Yeah.
And they were going to launch from there on the conventional invasion of Japan. And the dropping of the atomic bombs made that unnecessary.
Yeah.
Not that I'm saying I approve of the dropping of the atomic bombs, because I very much don't, but I think there were alternatives, but that's another story.
Yeah. Your dad's already fought in two theatres of war. He goes all over the world, and he goes to the Far East, and he experiences and sees kamikaze planes flying.
And very nearly was killed by one.
That's unbelievable. And then, obviously, the two atomic bombs, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There's the film's just been made recently about Oppenheimer to do with those, and there's still a big debate, isn't there, as to whether it was right to do that.
Yeah.
Your dad's literally in the midst of all these unbelievable historic events, isn't
he? He was there. What I really admired about him was that he came home, he took his uniform off, he said, "I've done my bit," and he went back to his Civvy Street job. And he, although he acknowledged the importance of commemorating war, he wanted nothing to do with glorification of it. And I actually lost his medals, because he had a number of... one of the things that was introduced during the Second World War was campaign medals. So if you were in a theatre of war for more than 24 hours, you were eligible for a campaign medal. And my dad, although he wasn't decorated, other members of my family were, particularly in the First World War, but not in the Second. But he had campaign medals, as did my uncle, simply having been in so many theatres of operation. And I lost his medals up the garden. That's how little regard he gave me them to play with, because he didn't think of them as something that he wanted to show off with, because he was frightened of it being perceived as showing off. And he always maintained the highest degree of respect for conscientious objectors. He said part of the reason we were fighting fascism, and it worries me about tendencies in society now, was to enable freedom of speech to be kept going, including people who have views that you don't agree with.
Yeah. I read actually this morning that there was 10,000 conscientious objectors in Britain in World War One, but 60,000 in World War Two. I might be incorrect with that. But basically, these were people who said, obviously, there's people who said, "I don't want to actively kill people," and there's others who said, "I don't want anything to do with it," you know what I mean? But funnily enough, my granddad, who fought in Africa for 5 years, whenever I spoke to him, he passed about 2005. Whenever I spoke to him, I actually did a recording with him in 2001 on a cassette tape, which chewed up. And it would have been the only recording of his war experiences. And that's why stuff like this is important.
Absolutely.
Because he threw his uniform and his medals away, and he said that was nothing to celebrate. And he used to speak about the job he did. And he was he used to acknowledge what the Soviets did on the Eastern Front as well. He said, you know, if it wasn't for them, we'd have had to fight another 80% of the German troops, etc.
Churchill himself said that the Red Army tore the guts out of the German war machine. That's a quote, and that's from Churchill.
In the latter stages of the Cold War and after the Cold War ended, a kind of acknowledgement of what happened on the Eastern Front and the tremendous sacrifices that were made, literally in just unbelievable numbers. I was reading about the 3 million Soviet troops that were taken very early in the war, who literally were all just starved to death in these huge open-air camps. 3 million of them died in these big camps. And the Second World War, things happened then that just... we hadn't experienced before.
The first mass gassings in Auschwitz were done on Russian POWs.
Yeah.
There was also terrible abuse of Russian prisoners by the Japanese.
Yeah.
They had a special unit for medical experimentation, which, by the way, the personnel from were recruited into the CIA in America after the war, along with German war criminals who'd experimented on involuntary subjects.
I think what happened on the Eastern Front in the Second World War, the technology, now you've got bombers, mass bombers, new atomic bombs, but there was a racial dimension to World War Two on the Eastern Front and to an extent in the Far East, which really, really was exacerbated by that technological development.
With regards to the treatment of prisoners of war, because he was in the Far East theatre of war, my dad, he'd previously been in the theatre of war dealing with the European fascists, the Nazis and the Italians. There, the Geneva Convention applied.
Yeah.
When he went to the Far East, I asked him, further to the comment I made earlier about him dying, I asked him, what were you most frightened of out there? And he said, not dying. One, sharks, and two, being captured by the Japanese.
Because of the conditions.
Because it was already known then, that late in the war, that the Japanese, they did take prisoners and they abused them, to put it very mildly.
Then you've got, is it Nanking, where 400,000...
Well, that was before the Second World War, but certainly a million people are supposed to... The Japanese behaviour in Manchuria, or Manchukuo as they called it, was absolutely grotesque.
I think the Japanese as well, it was interesting that they'd get soldiers, wouldn't they, and part of their, like, blooding into the war effort was to be in a pit... And they throw men, women, and children down, and their initiation was to bayonet them through the chest.
Yeah.
And then you go into the army, you've been brutalised.
Yeah.
And I think that the aftermath of the war for the Japanese and the Germans was this unbelievable, like, soul searching. Like, what are we all about? How could people do what they did on those theatres in the East, and particularly on the Eastern Front, the starvation that happened on the Eastern Front, the Holocaust? Just defies belief to actually, like you said with the kamikaze thing, like, oh, we know we're losing the war, so we're going to give our lives to the emperor or whatever. You had stepping up the Holocaust and spending a lot of resources shipping Hungarian Jews to Auschwitz and said, let's get this 500,000 killed before we lose the war. It's just a fanaticism. It's just absolutely terrifying.
Well, there were occasions when trains carrying war materials were competing with transports taking people to be gassed. Mm. And it actually got in the way of their war effort. But because it was so much part of their war aims, particularly given that they decided that if they were going to lose it, they were going to go down doing what they had come into existence to achieve, according to the Führer. Mm. And that was to ethnically cleanse.
It's incredible because... I know, like, the philosopher John Gray, who I haven't got much time for generally, he says that, like, people often treat the events of the 20th century as, like, much, much worse in terms of the human condition. But what he says, it was the actual technology which enhanced things that had happened before throughout history, some terrible things. And
there's an interesting set of historical ironies relating to one of the scientists who was regarded as just as Oppenheimer is regarded as, quote-unquote, the father of the bomb. There is a very, very renowned chemist called Haber, who was a German-Jewish person, who was the main architect of the use of war gases in the First World War. Mm. And his wife actually shot herself when she realised he was actually going to implement the use of, I think it was chlorine gas, on the Eastern Front against the Russians in the First World War. Mm. And eventually, because he was Jewish, he had to flee Nazi Germany and went to Oxford. And none of the Allied scientists would work with him because of his involvement with what had happened in the First World War. Now, he is also remembered. It's a bit like Wernher von Braun. Will history remember Wernher von Braun as the person who put a man on the moon, the chief scientist, or will they remember him for the V2s that could well have resulted in weapons of mass destruction being used on a full scale carrying nerve gas, because the Germans had stocks of nerve gas and the delivery system with the V2.
So the V2 rocket could literally be fired hundreds of miles, couldn't it? It
travelled at such a speed that it was uninterceptable.
Yeah.
You didn't even know it thing travelled beyond the speed of sound, so you heard the noise of it blowing up after it had blown up.
It's an interesting, I don't know if you've seen the film about the young student who was killed during the latter stages of the war. There was a young student, a girl killed. I always forget her name. They were called the White Rose Movement.
Yeah, the Scholl, Hans and Sophie Scholl.
Yeah, Sophie Scholl. She kind of... There's an interesting film about Sophie Scholl in German where the prosecutor's prosecuting, and she said, listen, what are you doing? And he said, oh, I'm just applying the law, you know, this is what we do. And I think to stand against that takes a lot of bravery. And... People are put in these terrible situations.
Unimaginable. Hitler was supposed to have said, with regards to the trial of the White Rose people, there was a famous Soviet prosecutor called Vyshinsky, who was the person who was the architect of the so-called show trials of the 1930s. Mm. And Hitler is supposed to have said, we need our Vyshinsky. And they appointed a multilingual, highly cultured chief prosecutor called Roland Freisler. And he was the person who subjected the bomb plotters and the people like the White Rose people to the most systematic public vilification in court before...
So the bomb plotters was the 1944 plot against Hitler. Is it the Stauffenberg plot?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Stauffenberg was a nationalist general who said Hitler's taken it too far.
He wasn't even the general. He wasn't even that particularly high ranking.
Is that right?
Yeah. And he was also very badly wounded. Yeah. And he became disaffected with the Nazi cause and regarded Hitler as being, you know, from having idolised him, regarded him as being unhinged.
Yeah. But Stauffenberg and the White Rose, they were concerned about Germans being killed in unnecessary death. Like, people perceived them as these radicals. He was just saying, listen, this has got to stop. And they were absolutely destroyed, the consequences of that. And it's a bit like, when you look at, like, the 30s show trials in the Soviet Union, the Nazi fanaticism for Hitler, it becomes like a religious cultish thing, which becomes very dangerous, which we're seeing semblances of with Trump.
Couldn't agree more.
January 6th didn't happen. He can do no wrong. I mean... Again, people might say, you're conflating the two. You go into a museum where Hitler's talking and they have it over the speakers, which I think happens in the Imperial War Museum in London. And you go in there and you go, I don't even know what he's saying, but there's a power to that.
Yeah, there is, yeah.
When the subtitles come up, he's talking absolute nonsense. You listen to Trump speak, there's a power to his speech, but you do know what he's saying, of course. He's talking complete nonsense. And there's a religiosity and a cultish dimension
to it. It's a sleep of reason, and that's the most dangerous thing about it, is that the argument doesn't win because there is no argument. Mm. Somebody said recently from the platform at one of the demonstrations I've been on, the power of rhetoric is the way it makes you feel, not the way it makes you think.
I think the left, we discussed earlier about problems with divisions on the left. We're really going off piece here. And I just want to say, folks, Ralph brought quite a lot of notes for this podcast about his dad's experiences of World War II. As soon as he started, he maintained eye contact with me, didn't look at his notes, remembered every name, every syllable and every fact. So, well done,
Ralph. There's one little sequel about my dad's war experiences I really do want to relate.
Go on.
And this is when the war was over. As I think I mentioned early on, my uncle probably pulled strings to get my dad into the Navy.
Yeah.
My dad, it was a bit of a Private Ryan situation because they served on too many ships together, because if they'd both been killed, my mum, for one, with the young son, wouldn't have been left with anyone to provide for her, given the way families were structured at that time. But anyway, my dad returned the favour because he had a word with the captain, and the captain, and I've got the certificates of continuous discharge, which all seamen have, of my uncle's, with my dad's ship's name on it, because they got him transferred onto the ship's complement so he could be demobbed earlier, because the ship my dad was on was coming home a long time before my uncle's ship.
Really?
Anyway, they're both on HMS Amish sailing across the Indian Ocean. And the way my dad told it to me, the captain said to him, hey, James, he said, have you any idea what that wooden packing case on the flight deck is? My dad said, well, no, sir, I would have thought it was... You'd know that from the ship's manifest. So the captain said, no, I've had a look at it, and there's no indication of what it is. So he said that there is no trace of where it came from or how it come to be there. Have a word below decks and see if you can find out, or, you know, amongst the officers, see if you can find out if anybody's got anything to do with it or is, you know, letting on. So my dad had a bit of a snout round. He went back and he said, no, sir, nobody's twigging. Nobody's admitting anything to do with it. So the captain said, OK, fair enough. He said, get the ship's carpenter and the ship's engineer to me with their teams. So my dad did this. And then the next thing, the captain gets on the tannoy on the bridge. All hands on deck, at attention, on the flight deck, facing the wooden packing case that is on the flight deck. So the ship's company are all standing to attention. The captain goes out and he says, it has come to my attention that there is no record in the ship's manifest from their lordships of the Admiralty of any request or any origin for this thing being here. Would somebody like to explain what it's doing here and take responsibility for it? Step one pace forward. Nobody does. So he said, OK, I'll give you a couple of minutes to think about it and I will ask again. Does nobody twigs? He says, right, OK, ship's carpenter, break it open. So they broke it open, and inside it was an immaculate Lagonda motor car. Now, Lagonda, probably designed by Walter Bentley after he left Bentley Motors. Top of the range, it could obviously not have been an ordinary Matlow. I mean, by the way, seamen always called each other's Matlow. They never referred to themselves as sailors.
Yeah.
Certainly Royal Navy ones. He said, I'll give somebody a last chance to take responsibility for this contraband. So nobody does. He says, right, okay, given that this contraband has not been authorised by their lordships, I will now give an authorisation for a message to be sent to their lordships of the Admiralty saying the longitude and latitude of His Majesty's ship Amir at this moment in time on the surface of the Indian Ocean, put it over the side. And whoever had it, and whoever was trying to work a flanker getting it brought back to England for nothing by the Navy, had to watch it dumped over the side of the ship.
Oh, my goodness.
And it must have been an officer, because no ordinary rating could have afforded to have bought it. He probably got it cheap off a Maharaja or something. But
That's quite a tale, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that is the example of the importance of oral history.
Yeah.
That's not going to be recorded in a history book.
Yeah, that's phenomenal. Just one last thing as well. My granddad resented the loss of his years of 20 to 25 and being in the war effort. And as someone now who's 47, looking back at the best years of your life, to be spending it in mortal danger, surrounded by Germans, injured by shrapnel like my granddad was. People are human. We're all human beings and we get caught up in these terrible situations.
Yeah.
These are people's lives.
And that's if you're not injured. And that's regardless of the fact that it might have ended up very differently and you might have ended up being on the losing side and having a world dominated by fascism.
That's right. And if my granddad had been killed, he had a bad wound on his back. I wouldn't be here. My mum wouldn't have been born. And again, that's the miracle of us being here now, the things that have led to us being here discussing this, incredible, but that you've got to know your history. The other thing I'll just recite is my granddad came back, he was a trained carpenter, skilled worker, and he got a job on Southport Road. I've spoken about this before on the podcast, but I'm going to mention it again about the importance of politics. And he said he went up to Southport Road, which was all fields, now it's all conurbation urban, and he said he was working on building houses, and people would go round forming, and if they weren't happy with you, they'd say, you go home, we don't want you here, at lunchtime.
Yeah.
And he said, we just fought a war, and we're coming back to that. And he said that was why the 1945 general election was so important. We'd won the war, now we wanted to win the peace, because we knew what life was about. And after World War One, there was very much an appreciation of life. World War Two, and I think since COVID, I think it's still early days yet, what the impact
long-term consequences.
On
yeah, I mean, certainly, I think that the outcome of the Second World War was largely determined because, one, you had a collective struggle for national survival, which had got people used to the idea of collective endeavour, and it not being about profit, mere profit, it being about delivering the goods for everybody, and also because there had been, it was a second occasion where. It was a khaki election, remember, the 45 election. And the old soldiers who'd been through the First World War said, look, lad, don't let them do to us what they did to you, what they did to us in 1919. Land fit for heroes to live in. And we had unemployment and the Depression.
Yeah.
And make sure this time we've got a second chance to democratise society in favour of a society that works for everybody. And that's what you know, you've got to bear in mind.
Yeah.
And I think that had a major influence. Because bear in mind, oh, my dad said, jokingly, but I think it's quite poetic. He said, what got us through the war? And he was by no means a Churchill admirer as such. He said, what got us through the war, I think is a lovely way of putting it, was Churchill's speeches and the WRVS handing out ciggies and tea on the platforms to the troops.
They were the women volunteers.
Yeah, on the stations when the troops were moving.
Yeah, keep up morale. But yeah, I mean, despite Churchill's flaws, he very much was a man of the moment, the type of man that Johnson and maybe people like Trump claim to be, who don't come close. He did unite the nation, didn't he?
Yeah.
We'll leave it there. We're just now over an hour. Just want to say thank you so much for that. We are going to talk about the Holocaust, Israel, Palestine. Maybe we can do that together. That'll be interesting.
Yes, it will.
We're going to talk about animal rights as well and veganism, etc. And anyone out there, I think we've lost all the cultural conservatives already when you just mentioned about collectivisation after World War II. Even if your, you know, animal rights isn't your thing, I think it'd be good for us to chat about that and for other people to listen to it. And the Holocaust, we've both got experience of going to the sites of the concentration camps and we've both quite big on Israel, Palestine and its history and what's going on now and what we hope for the future there. So check back in with us in the future, folks, about that. Ralph, thank you so much for your time. Anything else you want to add?
No, that's fine. It's a privilege.
Brilliant, yeah, and such an honour. And you speak so well, Ralph, and I'm so glad that this has been recorded for posterity.
Yes, yeah, so am I.
It's 2024. If anyone's listening to this in 3024, it's a nice sunny day in Liverpool. And, you know, I hope you're having a good day, and I hope you've learned from your history too. But I hope everyone's got something from this.
Let's not hope we're not talking to you from the past, from before World War III.
Yeah, yeah. That's I think that's why history is important.
And
I
yes,
think
exactly.
Anyway, listen, I could go on. We could go off on a million tangents. Ralph, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure, mate.
Cheers.